Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Matthew Shepard's death change the world? And how do the people who knew him personally separate the victim he's come to symbolize from the vibrant, warm, and magnetic human being he was in life? It's been nearly 11 years since the 21-year-old college student was savagely beaten and tied to a fence in Laramie, Wyoming. At the trial of Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney, witnesses testified that the pair had deliberately set out to attack a gay man. From the moment the shocking story broke, the name Matthew Shepard has become a touchstone in the struggle for equality under the law for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered Americans, and been attached to pending legislation that would classify crimes motivated by gender and sexual orientation as hate crimes. His mother, Judy Shepard, continues to fight for the protection her own son was denied as a co-founder, along with her husband, Dennis, of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. But there was more to Matt Shepard's life than his violent death, and Judy Shepard shares her memory in her new book, The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. Judy, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Welcome. You have said that you still haven't come to terms with your son's death, and that in a way you really don't want to. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, I know people saying, you know, is it better? Does it get different? I don't want to come to terms with it because I think the reason that I do what I do and the reason I can do what I do is that I keep Matt with me. And if coming to terms with it seems like a phrase you would use, like maybe it doesn't really seem as important as it was before or as horrific as it was before. And I don't want to lose that that thought. I think that's what keeps me going.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you had to learn to recognize the difference between Matthew Shepard, the young man whose death made him a symbol for the fight for justice for LGBT Americans, and the person you called Matt, your son.
Right.
Can you talk about why that separation is so important?
Well, I think the reason I wrote the book, Chris, was because I wanted the people who knew my son Matt as Matthew and only as Matthew, that they get to know my son Matt, to introduce him foibles and wrinkles and all to the public. It's unfair to his memory, to him, to only be remembered as the young man, angelic as he appears, tied to that fence. He had a life before that, and I think it's just really important to the community and to everybody to know that what he was really like.
From the first pages of the book, we see Matt as this really amazing, incredibly open and empathetic person. Will you talk about what he was like when he was a little kid?
Yeah, he was. You're right, empathetic. My mom. He would come sit on my mom's lap, and she was having a bad day, and he would say, Grandma, did something happen to you today? Are you not having a good day? And she looked at me and said, how can this four-year-old know exactly what that means to not be having a good day, that he would know and recognize in someone else that that was happening? He just seemed to have a sense about what people around him were feeling, sometimes thinking, especially if they were down in the dumps.
He reminded you and your husband at one point that his little brother expected an Easter bunny present,
right?
Which you had not had thought to provide.
Right, right. It was sort of thinking of others ahead of his own expectations, his own wants and needs. Sometimes, not always, for sure. He was a child, but he did have a sense of wanting others to be happy and taken care of.
Judy, you write very poignantly here about the fact that the agony your family endured was made considerably worse by the media attention you had to deal with when the story first was made public. Did you recognize at the time that that unwanted attention could ultimately turn into something that you could use for the benefit of what you wanted to do?
No, we didn't. Mostly we just viewed it as an intrusion, an unwelcome intrusion, and questioned even why it was happening. It wasn't until a few months later that we were having a discussion, a family discussion, about how surprised we were that the media was still as intense as it was, that we began to realize perhaps we could use this to help us further the cause. So that's when we began to sort of, you know, make use of the opportunities the media presented.
It's really striking to me that when Matt was still in the hospital, he survived for several days but never regained consciousness after he was attacked. You decided that you should go out and get some thank you notes because you had heard from people, and you bought a pack of 25. And ultimately, I know you heard from tens of thousands of people.
We did indeed. many people who sent cards and letters and dollar bills and $5 to try to help us with the medical bills or go and get a cup of coffee or something. It was really quite moving. And at the end, we didn't know what to do with that money. That's when we started the foundation, actually, was with that money that was sent to us while Matt was in the hospital and soon after. And now we look back and think we did those 25 cards. I still have those original 25 cards all made out to the people who sent us gifts, the first of the gifts to the hospital. We had no idea. It wasn't even until we left the hospital that we found out how many actual flowers came, and stuffed animals and gifts just the hospital to Matt's room. There were so many, they couldn't send them all to the room. They were dispersed through the hospital.
And one thing that was really difficult for you when he was in the hospital was that you and your husband really wanted time alone with him, and yet you discovered how many close friends he had that also wanted to be there.
Yeah, that was kind of hard. I think it was harder on Dennis than it was on me. I don't think he realized how important Matt was to these people, how important they were to Matt. He wanted Matt to be just Matt for us, for the family. But Matt loved his friends. And they were all very close to him and loved him as much as we did. I felt that they deserved every opportunity to be with him, and he would want to be with them.
He sounds like a guy who never knew a stranger.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. And he knew right away whether you were going to be a friend or not. He was quick to know people, and his judgments, his interpretations were frequently right.
You started to suspect that he might be gay long before he actually told you himself. How did you feel when you came to understand that?
I had several gay friends in college, and I knew that it's just who you are. I knew there's no amount of choice there. It's not a choice of a lifestyle, and if it was, that's their decision. But it isn't. It's so not. It's aggravating. It's irritating when people say that they make that choice to be in the gay community. I mean, common sense, why would you do that when you could be fired from your job or discriminated against and it's okay for people to hate you and hurt you even? I knew it was what it was, and I knew that my son was the most important thing in the world to me, his happiness and his security, and we were just going to deal with whatever happened.
But you did wait for him to tell you himself as opposed to approaching him.
Right. I know it's such an individual process. I know some parents, even some kids, wish their parents would approach them, start the conversation. But I knew Matt well enough to know that if I had approached him first, he would have retreated further. He would have not come out to me.
One thing that I think is really interesting is that this book is definitely written with a mother's love, but you give us Matt warts and all. He had some tough times as a teenager,
right,
and as a young man. Why is it that you think it's important not to allow this sort of one-dimensional portrait of him as the perfect paragon of an American college student to remain in people's minds?
Well, I have run into a lot of young people in particular who feel that Matt's life is not representative of theirs when they struggle with depression and issues with self-esteem. I want them to know that Matt suffered from the same things. It's not unusual. It's not a unique situation, in particular among the gay community, among young gay men. I just felt it was a disservice to Matt to people think that he was something that he wasn't. He was a great kid. Don't get me wrong. He was smart, funny, loving. He was an amazing young man, but he did have issues, and it's unfair to him to not talk about those issues with the public and the community in particular.
And I guess it's also important to stress that he deserved protection because he was a human being, not because he was a perfect human being.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Did you struggle with the idea, after having so much media invasion of your privacy, of giving up these last sort of precious stories that maybe were known only to you and your family?
Yes, that definitely was an issue. We had many discussions about photographs that we share, stories that we share about the public, how much we want to keep about Matt to ourselves, to just be ours, our Matt. The stories that I tell in the book, they're really not, they're not 100% new. I've told many of them in different places to either friends or gatherings or even my lectures at colleges. But you're right. There's a sense of giving him away that it might diminish him in your own memory, but that's really not not what's happened. What's happened when we share these memories is that they are brought back to us tenfold from other people.
And in fact, you don't, other than on the front cover, you don't put photos in the book.
No.
Mm-hmm. You initially kept your suspicions that Matt was gay from your husband. Why do you think you weren't ready to talk to him about what you thought?
Well, I actually did tell him that Matt was gay. Before, when Matt told me, he asked me to not tell his dad, but I told him anyway, because I thought Dennis needed the opportunity to sort of process, because Dennis, God love him, frequently speaks before he thinks, and I didn't want him to say something that might hurt Matt that he couldn't take back, mm-hmm. not out of rejection, but out of ignorance. So I told Dennis, and he said, you know, I get that. It's just going to take me a little while to get used to the idea. But we didn't talk about it after that. I think Dennis wanted to wait until, that's not really true either. We talked about it a little bit, but not in great philosophical discussions about what do you think about this and what do you think about that. It was more like Dennis wishing Matt would tell him so that they could actually have a discussion. Hmm. But he felt he needed to wait until Matt was ready, and I think that was the right choice.
Now, Dennis, your husband, is in the oil business. So I guess when Matt was a teenager, the family moved to the Middle East, and he was really excited about going to boarding school. Can
right.
you talk about that?
Right. There weren't any American high schools where we were in Saudi Arabia, so all of the children of the expats living there went to boarding school paid for by the company. Matt chose to go to a school in Europe, and his little brother, Logan, wanted to go back to the States, so a few years later, when he was ready for high school, he went back to Minnesota. Matt went to high school in Switzerland, and he absolutely loved it. He loved everything about it. He loved the people. He loved the travel. He loved the history of the locations, the different culture, the different foods. He just was in seventh heaven in Europe.
And you had been thinking that this might be great for him, a sort of a new environment as he was going through high school.
Right. New friends, an opportunity to sort of like reinvent yourself. He had many, many friends in Casper, but I just began to feel like he was in kind of a rut. He didn't really seem like he was 100% comfortable there. I totally get it, especially now that I've talked to so many other people in a similar situation. He didn't really feel like he fit in, and I don't think he really understood why he felt that way, even though he had many friends in Casper, many, many friends in Casper, dear friends. I thought a new opportunity, a new school, a new learning process would really be helpful for him. And it was.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to have a lot of contact with him when he was there in school?
You know, not so much. Those years ago, it was very expensive to do phone calls. The internet was just happening, wasn't everywhere. We communicated a lot by fax. Snail mail was definitely snail mail. So we did a lot of communicating by fax. We spoke once or twice a week, but just briefly, because I think phone calls were like $5 a minute or something.
Judy Shepherd is my guest. She's co-founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. Her new book is called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Judy Shepherd. She is co-founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation, and her new book is called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Judy, when Matt was in this at this boarding school in Switzerland, the class went on a trip to Morocco, and it turned out to have really devastating consequences for him. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, they were there. I think about eight of them, students, fellow students, said in Matt's senior year that on a senior trip, took a trip to Morocco, and they were in Marrakesh. In the evening, I think the rest of the kids had retired, and Matt decided to go back down to the bazaar. And he was attacked, raped by three locals. He never really recovered from that. He became a victim, the posture of a victim. He had depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, really. I guess it was, none of us were the same after that.
And he tried to cope in various ways. He did seek some help, but was drinking a lot after that. And I know that you were really worried about him during this time.
I was worried. I'm not really sure how I would characterize. He was self-medicating. He had prescription drugs to deal with the depression, but he didn't take them when he felt good. So he would take them when he felt bad, and that's really not how they're the most effective. So I did worry about that. And the drinking along with the drugs is never good. He became legal age, which, you know, when you turn 21, that's kind of what you do, is go to the bars. It was a troublesome time. I was worried, particularly because of the depression.
Were there flashes in that time where you thought he's going to be okay?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. But I don't know if I made them up or if they were really there. I just so much wanted him to be okay. I think I grasped at every positive thing that happened and tried to make it be the answer to the problems. And then, you know, it wasn't.
And then when you ultimately received that phone call at 5 o'clock in the morning, you assumed that it was Matt who used to call you at all hours, forgetting the time difference.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And I think every parent can imagine how excruciating that was. You didn't know until you arrived, though, quite how bad off he was.
Yeah, the hospital was not very forthcoming on details. I don't know if it's because they just didn't really know the full extent of his injuries while he was in Laramie. They sent him on to Fort Collins, where the hospital was very equipped to deal with neurological injury, particularly the severe as Matt's. So I'm not really sure. They weren't very forthcoming with details. So it wasn't until we got to Colorado that we heard the full extent of his injuries. That's correct.
And we should remind people who haven't seen photographs that Matt was not a big guy. In fact, the first sheriff's deputy to respond to the scene thought he was a child.
Right, he was quite small, 5'3", 5'4", 105 pounds, 110 on a good day.
Hmm.
Very small.
You made the decision to be at the trials of his attackers.
Right.
Was that hard for you to decide that you would sit through every detail?
Well, I knew it was going to be hard, and it was hard, but it was also necessary. I had to be there to remind the jury, the judge, the lawyers, the courtroom that Matt was a real person, not just a newspaper article or a name on a page. He was a real person with family and friends who loved him and missed him. I felt it was very important to be a presence in the courtroom.
And ultimately, at the time of sentencing, your husband made a very lengthy and eloquent statement about how he felt about the prospect that these young men might face the death penalty as opposed to life in prison. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, the death penalty is a part of the law in Wyoming, and what those two men were charged with and later found guilty of, Aaron McKinney, were the death penalty was part of the sentencing mandated by law. We'd had a discussion with the prosecuting attorney about the death penalty before either trial started, and he wanted to know our personal feelings about it, and we wouldn't share that with him. We felt that was really not our position, that he needed to follow the law, and no matter what. We never stated our opinion on the death penalty until after the McKinney trial. But it became clear to us after the verdicts came in, and the defense attorneys approached the prosecuting attorney and suggested that McKinney would take the same sentence as Henderson, and that would remove the death penalty option from the jury's decision on sentencing. After much discussion with everyone involved, we concluded that it would be better for us if we agreed to that, because we didn't really think that Matt would want that, and when it becomes a personal issue, your ideas sort of, you know, they change. we'd had a discussion as a family that sometimes the death penalty is the proper thing to do. And this was right after the James Byrd Jr. incident in Jasper, Texas. And there was no question about who was guilty. There was no question about why they did it. And there certainly was a question about wanting those men in the general prison population teaching hate from their bloody pulpits in the prison. So we decided that removing the death penalty was the best because we'd never have to deal with either one of them again. There would be no appeals, there would be no more court appearances, and our son Logan would not have to worry about his future in dealing with them. So we took the option of the two consecutive life sentences for both men.
Have they apologized?
No, and I don't expect them to. Henderson was a follower and McKinney was the leader. I'm not sure they even feel remorse right now, maybe for the fact that they are in prison, but not for why they're there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Judy Shepherd is my guest. She's got a new book out called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes. This terrible event placed you, unfortunately, on the front lines of the culture wars in America. And you may spend the rest, if you choose to, you may spend the rest of your life there. What are your thoughts on whether America will ever really accept the conclusions of Alfred Kinsey about human nature and sexuality? Because we have such a problem with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your call. And I will be on the front lines until the civil rights are, all of the civil rights are granted to the gay community that are currently being denied to them. And in the last 10 years, I have seen great change at the grassroots level, not unfortunately at the legal or legislative level federally yet, but it's going to happen. It is going to happen. And in fact, in my opinion, the culture wars are over. It's just every battle now becomes a little more significant to those who oppose us. Whether we will change hearts and minds as quickly as we change legislation, I don't know. It's 40 years after the civil rights movement of the 60s, and we still have racial issues. Those issues are not over yet. But as long as we continue to teach hate and discrimination to our children, it'll be there. I'm of the opinion that human sexuality is very complicated, very complex, and I really don't need to understand it to accept it for what it is, and that's human emotion and human sexuality.
You tell a story of sort of a happier time in your life when both your sons were alive, and you sort of let them know that you weren't interested in knowing exactly about their sex lives.
Right.
But you came to the realization that really has a lot more to do with relationships than sexuality.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find when I'm at events and I introduce my gay friends to my straight friends, I'm thinking in my head, right now, my straight friends, they're thinking about the sexual practices of my gay friends. And this, we all do that. It's just a, I don't know. It's a curiosity. It's an ignorance. It's a bias, actually. I never, when my friends meet someone straight, they never go to the bedroom there. It's just the gay community. But as soon as we begin to understand that love among same-sex couples is not just about the sex, that it is a relationship, things will change. Right now, we're just having a little problem getting over that part.
We have an email from Rollins who says, knowing what you've learned and what you know, can you share your feelings regarding how don't ask, don't tell remains the unspoken policy throughout our culture?
I don't know why it remains. It's one of the most ridiculous pieces of policy ever written. It's just absurd. It serves no one. It damages everyone. It's not observed. It's ridiculous. And the sooner that it's removed, the better. I'm disappointed that the administration hasn't taken a stronger stand to actually get it done. I know that other things are happening right now, very, very big, big things like healthcare and the economy, the war in Afghanistan. But my gosh, don't ask, don't tell is just one of the most absurd pieces of policy ever.
Talk about the status of the Matthew Shepherd Act. This has been something that has been in different forms through the legislature multiple times. The last vote from the Senate, I think, came last month. Where are we on that?
Well, it passed on the standalone bill in the House and went to the Senate and was attached to the Department of Defense bill and passed. Right now it's in conference because it changed a little, because now it's attached to the Department of Defense bill. It has to go through conference. It has to be reconciled, go back to the House. I believe it'll go back to the Senate, and it'll go to the President's desk. We know this time that the current president will sign it if it gets to his desk. What I'm concerned about is that 2 years ago we were in the same place, and it was removed in conference. We're not 100% sure that that isn't going to happen this time, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Andrea in McKinney. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was very moved when I watched a show that involved Matthew. Very moved. I'm a 30-year-old woman. And I was wondering, how involved is the family in any productions made about Matthew?
Well, there were a few things done. There was the Laramie Project, which is absolutely an amazing piece of theater, and also a film on HBO. There was an NBC project that is kind of about... The movie itself was a good movie, but it didn't need to be called The Story of Matt, because it really wasn't about Matt specifically. A lot of things in the movie were misleading and just plain wrong, which is actually one of the reasons I wrote the book. Many things perpetuated by that movie are just incorrect, and I wanted to set the record straight. We're not that involved in anything that's going on in that direction. The Laramie Project is doing a 10-year epilogue production. I was a little bit involved in that. I did an interview with Moises Kaufman. Other than that, it's sort of been done without us.
I think people would imagine, you know, the work that you're doing now and the commitment that you have and think how obviously difficult it is for you to have to revisit this every time you do an interview or write an op-ed or something. One of the ways that you've learned to sort of protect your own heart is to try very hard not to visualize the crime itself.
Right. I can't. If I start to form pictures in my head, I completely freeze up. I can't do it. So I try desperately not to bring back memories or visions of what I do know and then of what I think I know. Of course, I didn't see the crime scene or any of that, but I don't even want to try to imagine that. I would be paralyzed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Jacqueline in Richardson. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hello. Can
Hi.
You hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. This is for Judy, of course. And this is a comment. My daughter was a year behind in school in Switzerland.
Really?
Matt, yeah, she went to school at the school. Anyway, Matt was the first boy she met. At the school, and he was so kind to her and so very friendly. They became very good friends, but he made a transition from a 15-year-old girl to, or 16, 15, whatever, to a very, you know, unusual place, a very wonderful place. But anyway, I met Matt myself, and I think he's a wonderful boy.
Oh, thank you for calling. That's so wonderful. Thank you so much.
And take care. Good
thank
luck.
You.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Jacqueline. I would imagine that here and there, you do run into people that you hadn't expected would have a direct connection to your son.
That's right. It's been really wonderful. I occasionally meet people on the road that knew Matt before. This particular instance with the book, I'm just hearing from scores of people. It's amazing. Hmm.
And I wonder how often they share things that make you laugh or make you smile, at least, that you hadn't known before.
Many times. Mm-hmm. Many times. A lot of things I didn't know about Matt, because we didn't live with Matt since he was 16, because he went to boarding school and then to college, and we were overseas, so there's a lot of things about his life I'm very unfamiliar with. So it's just wonderful to hear stories now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jose in Dallas. Hi, Jose.
Hi. I'm sorry for your loss. I wanted to make a quick comment about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I'm a veteran. I think that very much like Jim Crow, it kind of creates a haven for the ignorant. If we're ever really going to make any real progress, there's going to have to be a line drawn and then enforced, enforced aggressively for there to be real change. I am a former, I don't know if it was a homophobe or if I was just prejudiced or bigoted, but if in my extreme case, which I lost some very close friends because of my ignorance and because I wasn't mature, then if I can change, then anyone can. But as long as people have a place to retreat in ignorance, then they're going to.
Jose, what changed your mind or your heart?
Really? Well, it's kind of a long story. I've always wanted to be a dad. And in my family, we have big legs, but very sloped shoulders. So when I was going to get married, I was looking for a woman with wide shoulders. And I met my wife when we got married, and we were lounging around one day, and I looked at her shoulders, and I was saying, those are very manly shoulders. And then, at that point, that kind of started the idea that the only difference between men and women is going to be, aside from anatomy, is going to be hormones. So once that line was blurred, it all didn't make sense. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So people are people. People love people. The heart wants what the heart wants, and that's the way we're created. And once you come to that realization or you find that truth, either you've got to embrace truth or you're going to choose to be ignorant. And I've never been one to embrace ignorance.
I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
In your own family, it was nice to read that even these sort of older generations were fine with Matt.
Yeah, to my knowledge, no one that Matt had the time to come out to rejected him. I think maybe even we all might have known before he told us. We've never really discussed it, but there was never any question of his acceptance. My mother, even in her advanced years, said to me, I don't understand what all the hubbub is about. He's gay, so what? He loves somebody different, so what? I don't really get what this is all about. But then on the other hand, in the very next breath, I said, Mom, would you be interested in meeting Matt's boyfriend? And she said, oh, no. I love Matt because he's my grandson. I don't care. But the rest of it, I'm not really sure. So there was a limited kind of acceptance, but given enough time, I'm sure she would have come around.
Judy Shepherd is my guest. She's co-founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. Her new book is called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Judy Shepherd. She is co-founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. Her new book is called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. She'll be in Dallas in October to receive the Elizabeth Birch Equality Award at this year's Black Tie Dinner fundraiser. And Elizabeth Birch is actually a friend of yours.
She is. She's a great friend. She's actually one of the main reasons I'm doing what I'm doing today.
When you started and first imagined being some kind of activist for GLBT rights and for justice, you imagined yourself in a kind of behind-the-scenes role. Can you talk about how that began to change?
Well, if what had happened to Matt hadn't happened, I'd be the pea-flag mom making cookies for the meeting, not the one at the podium. But after Matt was killed, I met people like Elizabeth Birch, who sort of educated me and helped me deal with what was happening at the time with the press and the outcry from the gay community. And we began to realize as a family that we had a window of opportunity where perhaps Matt's name or our name might make a difference if we would speak out. So in the year that we waited for the trials, I went on a great learning curve. As a family, we decided I would be the one to do that because somebody had to have a real job. So Dennis stayed in Saudi and Logan was in school. So it was me, and I just tried to learn as much as I could. Elizabeth and the Human Rights Campaign were invaluable in my education, my very steep learning curve. And then I began to do some college lectures, and I found I really enjoyed interacting with the young people and telling my story. It was actually keeping Matt with me to be able to tell this story. Wasn't sure I could. Public speaking really isn't something I ever aspired to do. I don't really like it. I'm an introvert off the scale, but I found this to be different than that, in that I'm just now telling my story. So I sort of thought about it like talking to my friends in my living room, and it became quite easy, and I really enjoyed meeting the people and learning from them.
How is Logan doing these days?
Logan is doing well. He actually works for the foundation in Denver. It took him a little while, I think, to come to grips with what had happened. He needed some time to become Logan before he was known as Matt's brother.
Yeah.
We gave him his space. We didn't talk about him publicly. A lot of people thought Matt was an only child until Logan was ready to be a part of what we do, if ever. We didn't expect or encourage or any of that. That totally came as his decision to be a part of the foundation. I'm just thrilled that he's decided to be part of it.
Yeah. How did he approach you and say, I think I want to do this work?
That's just what he said. I think I'm ready to do this now. Mm-hmm. He had some friends in college who were gay who, as he tells it, one day sat him down and explained to him how important the work is that we do for everyone, not just Matt. And I think it sort of started the cycle of thinking, you know, about what it meant in a bigger picture. And it was pretty amazing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jenny in Plano. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, wow. Hi. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Jenny.
Yeah, my name's Jenny, and I live in Plano. And I grew up in San Diego in a very strict Mormon family. And I'm not Mormon anymore. Ever since I was a kid, I've known for sure, without a doubt, that I'm bisexual. I'm 36 now. I'm married with children. I actually married my best friend. But when I left the Mormon church about 10 years ago, I started dating women because I had always wanted to, and I, to this day, am very proud of that, that I've been real with myself. I've been honest about who I am. I've been honest with my family and my friends, and I've always tried to use my voice to let people know that love is pure, regardless of how it looks, and that being different is not a bad thing. And I just wanted you to know that I just support you in all your efforts, and I just want you to know there are a lot of people out there like me who are trying to use our lives and getting all choked up. But we educate our children, and we're not afraid to talk about what's right. And I just want you to know that I'm a huge advocate for alternative lifestyles and just showing that homosexuality, bisexuality, it does not equate with promiscuity. And I just wanted to encourage people and our listeners to become friends with people that aren't exactly like they are, and to expand their horizons, and their lives will just become much, much better and much more beautiful, much brighter because of it.
Well, thank you, Jenny. From your lips to God's ears, thank you very much.
I wonder, do you do work with schools and with children? A lot of families who would like to be open and honest with their kids don't quite know how to start those conversations.
Yeah, I am mostly invited to colleges, and I don't try to push myself into places where I'm not actually wanted. I have some people working for me at the foundation in Denver who actually go into high schools and deal with those kinds of problems. I would love to start at preschool talking about difference because I really think that's when we begin to recognize prejudice and how people are different. If we can understand that it's not something to be feared, that it's something to be welcomed, that we're on a really good start. Hmm. But for some reason, my name sort of equates this vision of, you know, I don't know, I'm going to recruit people to be gay, which is like so ridiculous. but it's a little harder for me to get into to talk to younger kids than it is people from my staff.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, it's really interesting because now I know that the Matthew Shepard Foundation has taken an activist role in trying to secure marriage rights for gay and lesbian Americans. And it's fascinating to me because this is something that I'm guessing in Matt's lifetime was sort of off the radar screen for him.
You know, it was. When he first went to Laramie is when Hawaii was discussing same-sex marriage. And we had a discussion about it in his apartment. I remember it vividly. On the cover of Time magazine was the talked about the issue in Hawaii, and he asked me, do you think we will ever be allowed to marry? And I said, you know, Matt, I don't think I will see it in my lifetime, but I think you will see it in yours. Mm-hmm. Ironically, turned out the other way around. But it's just so important, and I just think it's part of the evolution of society that people are going to recognize, as Jenny did, that human sexuality is just very complicated, and we don't really need to understand it to accept it. That's just a great step forward.
Has it helped you that in fact, in making these arguments, does it help that you are straight? Do you think that gets you into places and into people's hearts that wouldn't listen if you said, this is how I feel, and I'm a lesbian?
You know, it's I think so. Several people have told me that if they tried to say the same things on stage that I do, as a lesbian or a gay man, the audience just wouldn't be listening. The process would be, oh, there's another gay individual whining about what they don't have, wah, wah, wah. But based on where I come from, how I got there, losing my son to hate, anti-gay hate, sort of gives me some standing that maybe a member from the community would not have. A different story to tell, if you will. And I do think that I get different audiences because of that.
I wonder what you hear from moms and dads who maybe have struggled with a child and say, okay, I think I can do this now.
I would love to hear stories like that, and I would love to think that that's what's happening. I don't know that it is. Everything is so individual based on family backgrounds and family histories and even where they live that my story may not even relate to anyone else's story.
I think it's pretty interesting, and I guess your husband has made this joke that you often speak in places where you have been welcomed and invited in, and some would say that's preaching to the choir, and your husband says, well, even the choir needs to practice.
Exactly. It's great. I love to say that. It makes people laugh, but it's true. Sometimes we just get so worn down by being rejected and refused in our request for equality. Prop 8 in California, for example, that was so defeating, deflating, sad, horrendous. The choir needs to be reminded that we just can't give up. We just need to keep trying because eventually it is going to happen.
How do you feel about the past decade of media portrayals of what it means to be LGBT in this country?
Well, I guess the good news there is the yin and the yang, right? I guess the good news is that the media is portraying the gay community. I loved it when Will and Grace was on and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, even though they were stereotypical. People watched them, and it became a little less unacceptable to be rooting for the gay community. They're stereotypical, definitely. But now we're seeing on TV shows and in movies and in literature real life situations with the gay community, on Brothers and Sisters, a gay relationship, and many shows have gay characters. Some stereotypical, yes, some not. But the fact is, it's happening, and that has got to be better than what not showing them at all.
Do you feel like people who agree with you have a responsibility to say it out loud as opposed to sort of being silent in the background and simply not contributing to the problem?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Based on the model of the civil rights movement in the 60s, it takes allies to make this happen. And we need everybody to be vocal. We need everybody to tell their story, members of the community and those who love them. Absolutely need to tell the story. We need to know that our pastor, our police chief, our banker, our next-door neighbor are gay because we're out there, we're everywhere. And the more we realize how much the gay community affects our culture today, our world today, I think the more willing we will be to accept them for who they are, wonderful human beings.
Judy, how do you think Matt's death changed Wyoming, if at all?
Well, you know, it changed it in that I think it made people make a decision. They couldn't just say live and let live anymore. They had to actually say, are you for gay rights or not? It sort of pushed them off the fence, if you will. The discussion there is sometimes not pleasant, but I don't think that makes Wyoming any different than anywhere else in the world, in fact. And it changed people just that they became more aware. Did it change opinions? I'm not really sure. There's still some anger there, people blaming Matt for what happened. I don't know. It's a difficult question. It's a complex issue for them.
There are still people out there who will say publicly that what happened to Matt was not a hate crime.
Right.
How do you begin to cope with that?
Well, in the most simple, basic way, all they have to do is read the trial transcripts, and those two men confess to the fact that they picked up Matt because he was gay, and they pretended to be gay to befriend him. That alone makes it a hate crime. Singling someone out based on who they are makes it a hate crime. It was a robbery. They intended to rob Matt. It went much, much beyond that. But initially, the very first part of the evening was a hate crime.
Do you think, had there been something in place like the Matthew Shepard Act at the time that he was attacked, would it have prevented his death or at least or simply guaranteed that the trial and what took place after would have been very different?
Well, we know that laws don't prevent crime, or we wouldn't need prisons, right? So I don't think it would have prevented anything. It was, certainly would have made the state of Wyoming, their particular instance of the cost of the investigation and the trial, easier for them, because they would have been able to apply for federal monies. Prevent? No. Educate? Maybe. I think one of the most important parts of hate crime legislation is the education that should come with it, sort of like traffic school. If someone is caught at the basic level of graffiti on a synagogue, for example, that they go to a school and they learn what diversity and acceptance is all about. If we can prevent one crime from happening by doing that, we've done a great thing. I just don't think that the world is educated enough right now to really fully understand their actions when they commit a hate crime.
What form would that sort of education take, do you think?
Just diversity training. One of the greatest things is in L.A. they do a program where they actually take offenders to the Museum of Tolerance, and they learn about what it is to be different in a world where you are not accepted based on the way you look or how you worship or how you love. It's a tremendous, it's an impactful experience. Just to be a part of that sort of opens people's eyes. Even if you think that you're not biased, there's this great display when you go into the museum, and one says, go through this door if you're not a racist. If you're a racist, use this door. Well, of course, everybody tries to go through the door that says, I'm not a racist, but that door is locked, because we all have some kind of prejudice that we use during our lives, whether it's the typical understated prejudice that exists, or something that's more hidden.
So I know that you have a website. Is it MatthewShepherd.org?
It is.
Okay. And people can keep up with what's going on with the legislation there?
Yes.
Yeah. And what other resources do you have?
We have lists of direct service providers around the country. We have a website where you can do write in to respond to blogs. We're getting ready to expand to be able to accept videos and podcasts. We have two websites, actually, MatthewShepherd.org, which talks about the foundation, and we have one called MatthewsPlace.com, which is for young people, that has news and things about the gay community geared toward probably the ages of 12 to 19, like 20.
Judy Shepherd is co-founder of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. Her new book is called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and a World Transformed. She will be in Dallas October 3rd to receive the Elizabeth Birch Equality Award at this year's Black Tie Dinner. Judy, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.